All right, let's get started. So I'm here today with Frank from the Rubicon Project. And Frank is very secretive about what he's been doing and won't tell anyone, including me, and hopefully today he's going to tell us a little bit what's happening in his project and in advertising and some of the other stuff. Frank, do you want to maybe start to tell us a little bit about you and your background and then a little bit about your company?
Sure, absolutely. So the Rubicon Project is actually my sixth company. Of my five prior companies, I've been through two acquisitions, one IPO, one failure, or as I like to call it, a character building experience. And then my last company was Strongwell Systems, a company that I self-funded here in Los Angeles, moved up to Silicon Valley a few years ago, raised some capital from Sequoia Capital, about $30 million in the company so far, and the company is still growing strong. I moved back down to Los Angeles about a year ago, and reconnected with the team from my third company, which is the company that's public. It was L90 Ad Monitor. If you don't recall the company, we were in the advertising space when we started. We were the seven boys in the Simcoe race. DoubleClick was the 1,000-pound gorilla in the space. Within a couple of short years, we actually became the number two player in the space. We hung DoubleClick. We had about 3,000 customers, delivered about 8 billion ads a month to those 3,000 customers, which reached about 65% of the internet. We took that company public, raised $120 million in our IPO, $500 million market cap at peak, and DoubleClick acquired. When I reconnected with the team that developed that product and that platform for me, we were just looking around at the advertising space and realized that not a whole lot has changed in the past 7 years. There's just an overall lack of innovation applied to the space, and we saw that while it's an incredibly large market, the $27 billion market in the U.S. alone, it's an incredibly inefficient one. Best way that I sort of characterize it is it's sort of like the stock market without an Nasdaq system. So we saw two trends occurring. One was that the website publishers were underserved, lack of technology that really exists for them. And two was that we saw this trend of a growing number of ad networks coming into the space. When I was in the space 7 years ago, there were 15 ad networks. A year ago, there were 100. And today, there are over 300 ad networks. Some of those are focused on very niche areas of the market. Like there's a women's ad network, a sports ad network, a gay ad network. There are now networks in India and China and Japan. Many of these didn't exist many years ago. So what we're doing here at the Rubicon Project is developing a service for website publishers to better monetize their unsold or remnants ad base. And the way we're doing that is we're actually pulling together and aggregating these 300 ad networks that exist on one side. So giving them full access to the market. And then on the other side, we've got technology that really deciphers the publisher inventory based on demographic, geographic, and contextual information. Then understand the strength of these networks and essentially matches up ad inversions with the networks that are best able to monetize it.
So would it be fair to say that what you're doing is along the lines of what Blue Lithium is doing, which is what they got acquired by Yahoo?
Blue Lithium did a fantastic job with behavioral targeting, and Blue Lithium is another ad network. We're finding that publishers are working with Blue Lithium, Dakota, 24/7 Media, they're using Google AdSense, they're using all these services, and each of these ad networks certainly have their strengths. And what we're doing is we're allowing the publishers to be able to work with all these ad networks, but work with them much more efficiently. So if Blue Lithium has certain strengths, they might get more of the publisher inventory where they're going to be successful. If Blue Lithium, as an example, doesn't have any advertisers in Mexico, it doesn't matter how good their technology is, they're not going to be able to monetize that inventory in Mexico. But if we can siphon that off and send that over to ad networks who are in Mexico or focus on the Mexico market, such as Latin3 or SpanClick, that's a win-win for everybody. Publishers now able to monetize inventory that they were normally not able to, just simply because of the areas of focus of a certain network.
Okay, so you're basically, what you're saying is that the CPA arena, there's been these mass CPA networks like CPA Empire, ClickBooth, Rextopia, Primary Ads, and Hydra, that are mass CPA networks, just general interest offers. And then the next progression from that, and then is these niche CPA networks that are focused around, like, there's a BizOff network, there's a Hispanic network, there's national networks. And what you're then helping those guys do is saying, okay, the Australia CPA network, they're going to be the best it is in Australia, and we're going to make it easy for you to aggregate your inventory with us, and so you can be the best in Australia. We'll then bring in international advertisers that want that Australia traffic and monetize that better than anyone. Would that be correct?
That's part of it. It's not just focused on CPA. CPA, CPM, CPC, it doesn't matter. At the end of the day, what we're doing is we're taking the publisher inventory, breaking it up into about 9,000 different microsegments. Mm-hmm. So it could be female sports enthusiasts in New York. And we're going to, use our technology to go out and figure out which ad network is going to do the best job monetizing these female sports enthusiasts in New York. It could be 24/7 Media this week because they might have a big ad buy with women's Nike stores. Mm-hmm. Whereas, 2 weeks from now, that big ad buy moves over to Aquantis. But Aquantis might do a better job monetizing that particular micro-segment. So you never know what's going to cause a particular ad network to do better or worse on a particular piece of inventory. And what we're just doing is kind of creating this free flow market where If networks perform on certain inventory, they get more of it. And if they're not performing on certain inventory, then we'll go, you know, allocate that inventory to networks that do perform on it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It's interesting. So that has the potential to really shake up the industry.
Yeah, you know, I think it's the industry today is shake up. There's constant churn of, you know, advertisers moving money around with different ad networks. You know, today they're spending money amongst 300 ad networks. So again, 7 years ago, it was 15 ad networks. So, you know, some, of course, they're spending more with, some, of course, they're spending less with. But there's more money being spread around in more places. And that creates more confusion for the publishers. And in order for publishers to really maximize the value of their ad space, they've got to be able to connect to all the funding sources. Now, the second piece of this equation that's challenging for the ad networks themselves is that they've got constant churn in their business. Again, it used to be 7 years ago where the ad networks went off and established either exclusive or semi-exclusive relationships with the publishers.
Right.
This is different, over, as you know. So today it's not uncommon for a publisher to work with, you know, 5, 10, 15, or, you know, we've seen even as much as 30 ad networks. And what that's doing is it's causing a lot of volatility for the ad networks, and it's creating a lot of churn in their business. So they're constantly trying to maintain this balance of advertiser dollars and buys versus inventory to be able to fulfill it. And what we're doing is actually, stabilizing that equation, not necessarily taking it.
I can talk more to the CPA side. I mean, right now is that, I mean, there's a lot of CPA networks that have guys running around selling that inventory. And there's a lot of stuff that's relationship driven. You know, there's this mutual trust and all this kind of stuff. And what you're talking about doing then is commoditizing that and saying, okay, the relationship's there. But at the end of the day, most people pay, most of the offers work reasonably well. We're just going to split half them all. And whoever's performing the best will do the best. So potentially, all of the advertisers at, a lot of the CPA networks with all their, employees or their affiliate managers, could all lose their jobs by what you're doing. Because it'll be automated. You'll be automating the entire process. Does that sound correct?
Yes, we are automating the process, but I don't necessarily agree with the statement that it's commoditizing it. I think, you know, commoditization occurs when market is saturated. Mm-hmm. I think right now we have just the opposite problem. I think we see that 80% of all the ad inventory on the internet goes unsold, and that's what's going to these ad networks today.
Right.
And the ad networks themselves, when they get a piece of inventory from a publisher, mm-hmm. They're not able to successfully sell all of it. So there's a portion of it that they sell, and there's a large portion of it that they don't sell. And that's where a lot of these guys are going and arbitraging that on the back end. They're doing this just because they don't want to lose access to that inventory, and they don't want to just, you know, go throw that inventory in the trash. So I think what we're doing is really making it more efficient. And in this case, you know, ad networks will get more of the inventory that they're successful with. So if they're driving high CPMs on, say, female traffic in the United States, mm-hmm. then they'll get more of that. And if they're not really focused or doing a good job on male traffic in the United States, they'll get less of that. So when the effective CPM comes back to the publisher from a particular network, you know, they're doing a better job with in areas that they're more successful, which means that the ad network's able to go drive more dollars from their advertisers, mm-hmm. which, of course, you know, ultimately benefits the publishers. But I think it's really just making that process more efficient. And I think we're a long way away from, you know, worrying about commoditization.
Well, I'm not saying that losing jobs is a bad thing. I actually thought that this sort of efficiency, I think that a lot of the ad networks will be out of business in the next 5 years in terms of the way they operate today, because a lot of it is relationship driven and it is going to be automated. And what you're talking about sounds like a very logical way to automate. I'm a proponent. I think there should be more efficiency in the system.
I think it's like any space. They're going to find areas where they can create more value add.
Right.
And I think we're seeing a lot of that happen today. You mentioned Blue Lithium. They're developing fantastic behavioral targeting technology to, you know, better convert for the advertisers.
Right.
Other folks, like some of these CPA folks, are doing a good job. You have post-click to turn click into higher quality leads.
And so what you're talking about then is, let's say we've got a site that has a range of demographics that hasn't been working particularly well anywhere. You can then bring in a bunch of these niche ad networks, aggregate more. Each of the niche ad networks can then do their thing really well, whether it's, the slices could get really thin. It could be 30 to 35-year-old males. It could be 16 to 18-year-old males. It could be all sorts of combinations. And your system will then put in place the ad network that is doing the best job at filling that inventory.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. Another piece of this is really frequency. So today it's really difficult for publishers to slice up their inventory, down into these different micro-segments to start. And two, it's hard for them to, you know, balance multiple networks to satisfy that inventory. So again, you know, advertisers are spending money in multiple places. Again, sometimes more with some and less with others. But if Gatorade, say, is doing a buy in multiple places, in multiple ad networks, let's just take three ad networks as an example. Say Gatorade spent $10. You know, they spend $3 with network A, $2 with network B, and $5 with network C. What we're able to do is allow the publisher to tap into all three of those ad networks, and maybe they get a dollar from each of those ad networks. Now they've made $3, whereas if they were just working with one of the ad networks, they just get a dollar.
And in the previous example, if they're working with just that one network, it's not automated either. And you automated that entire process. All they've done is stack your JavaScript on page and then it's tested and optimized.
Right, that's correct. That's correct. Yeah, the work to reward ratio quickly decreases increases as publishers are working with more networks, because that just means more tags, more deals that they need to go traffic and optimize. The way they're managing the stuff today is typically with Excel spreadsheets. They're doing it very holistically, not at a very granular level.
Yep.
So yeah, and that would be it's a management nightmare to work with multiple networks, especially even talking about dealing with different tags and the tag translation, the implementation, etc. And you're absolutely right. With our system, they basically take one tag and either insert it directly into their page if they don't have an ad server. Mm-hmm. If they do have an ad server, we essentially just get inserted into the ad server as a default unsold the remnant campaign.
So
what we're doing is connecting them to all the ad networks in the back.
So let me ask then, how do you know, what's the incentive for everybody to sign up? I mean, how do we know that Blue Lithium is in fact doing mostly this today? And it's just as the base of advertisers and networks grow, then they'll do this better.
First, we actually don't need the ad network to sign up. What we're essentially doing is providing this management service on behalf of the publishers. Mm-hmm. The publishers are working with these ad networks or want to work with these ad networks. We're just facilitating that relationship and making it more efficient. So it is completely transparent. Every ad network knows every publisher that's working with them and vice versa. Having said that, we could do a better job for both the ad networks and publishers if we do have a relationship with them. And we actually are going out there and establishing relationships with a number of ad networks. Today, actually, we've got relationships with 25 ad networks. Ranging from services like Adret to ad networks like Dakota and Hispanic. In that case, what we're able to do is get much more granular tag information from the ad networks, and what we're able to do is essentially do a better job matching, so we can again bring them more of the inventory that they're successful with.
Isn't this just a form of behavioral targeting? I mean, effectively, by having someone like Dakota sign up, aren't you saying that, well, you're doing behavioral targeting, but we just happen to be better at it?
We are adding information to Dakota, so we are labeling the publisher inventory. It's not just behavioral. I mean, some of it's based on geographic information, some of it's based on contextual. So we do use a combination of geographical, demographic, and contextual information to sort of pre-label and pre-sort that inventory. We are not by any means replacing the technology that the behavioral targeting companies have or any other technology for that matter. They're still able to leverage it. But at the end of the day, the ad networks are only going to be as successful as the advertisers that they have within that network and the amount of ad dollars that they have coming from those advertisers. So, again, as long as advertisers are spending money in multiple places, they could support the fact that publishers need to now connect to multiple places to reach as many of the ad dollars as possible.
So I get the point about sign-ups. What I guess I'm not completely understanding, and if you can bear with my slowness on this, is the actual targeting side of it. Is your targeting side of this different to what companies like Blue Lithium and Dakota are doing today? Because as I understand it, those guys are saying, well, we know this guy is a 26-year-old male. His IP address says that he's in the state of Florida. We know these other three things about him that we gathered over a period of time. Therefore, we're going to show this ad inventory.
There's certainly some overlap, but we are by no means looking to replace those technologies. Those technologies, at the end of the day, do a better job converting for the advertisers. Mm-hmm. Certainly that has some benefit to the publishers. But what they're doing is they're looking through and sorting through inventory and trying to figure out how can Dakota or Blue Lithium do a better job converting for the advertisers that exist within their networks.
Right.
One thing I should mention is that from a technical standpoint, we don't serve any ads. So there's no creatives actually put into our system. What we are is sort of a really smart or intelligent traffic manager. So in a typical deployment, if somebody would insert our tags as their default campaign, their default remnant campaign into their ad server. What happens at that point is the ad impression gets redirected to our service. We go and analyze that impression based on that demographic, contextual, and geographical information. We are constantly analyzing the strengths of each of the ad networks, and what we do is we make a decision. So ad impression comes in, we say, which network do you think is best able to monetize this impression? What we do is we actually redirect that impression to that network. So at the end of the day, if it's Blue Lithium, they are serving the ad, and they're leveraging all their behavioral other technology to serve it to the ads.
Let me see if I got it now. So what you're a meta service as the explanation is, it's not so much about behavior or any of these other kinds of targeting. You're taking just everybody's advertisers and like networks or any kind of network, and then you're doing the optimization for the publisher. And then over time, you'll get a feel for, and based on performance data, you'll get a feel for which network performed the best in on different publisher sites. Does that sound like a more accurate summary?
Yes, that is accurate. And I think an important distinction here is that we don't we don't know each of the individual ads. So whatever ads Blue Lithium or Dakota or AdBright want to serve, it's their technology that's figuring that out. Mm. Our technology is just simply saying, look, we sent over a piece of inventory. What is the publisher going to return? And at one point, does that start diminishing? So an example might be, we might send over a million impressions to Critico Network throughout the day for males looking at travel pages. Mm. At some point, that network is going to decrease in performance. Might be based on the ad dollars they have in the system, might be because they blew out a certain campaign and it's over. So we might start saying, punch the monkey ads.
Right.
And the punch the monkey ads aren't going to convert as high of a CPM. And once that happens, we say, okay, well, who else do we think can also monetize this inventory? So let's send that over to somebody else because we'd rather have somebody who has ad dollars that can monetize this than just showing that ad network's default punch the monkey ads.
So you're not actually doing any real behavioral targeting at all, are you? Your targeting is just based on historical data and what's the point.
Targeting isn't necessarily the best word. Targeting means, at least in my opinion, picking an ad to match that particular user. We are doing the analysis and the optimization to say, based on this behavioral information, which network or networks do we think or will monetize as best. So we're doing the analysis, but we're not necessarily targeting the end ad.
That's really interesting. So a big part of what you're doing then is integration with all these things. Like you're figuring out how to integrate with AdBright, and you're figuring out how to integrate with a CPA network and maybe Zito and all these others. Does that sound right?
Yes. And when we say integrate, part of that is centralizing all the data into one place. A large part of that, though, is figuring out all the different tag translations. So if we got 15 different ad tags from a particular network, so maybe one was for sports, another one was for females, another one was for U.S. traffic, then what we're doing is we're optimizing those individual tags. That ad network might have 15 campaigns behind one tag, but what we're doing is kind of balancing these things and testing them and figuring out how each of these perform in different segments of traffic. Some networks can get very, very granular. They'll give us 20, 30, 40 tags that match very closely to these different micro-segments that we're analyzing them against. Some networks only have the capability to give you one or two tags. In that case, we're trying to optimize to get a much more holistic or macro level.
I really like it. That's really interesting.
Well, thanks. I mean, it's an easy concept to really talk about, but there's certainly some pretty sophisticated and complex technology in the back end to make it work.
And then, when you take that out to people, how hard does it get people to sign up for it?
Well, we haven't launched it yet. Right now, we're bringing on some early alpha customers. We took it out to 50 publishers just to get their feedback. And what we found was that 48 of them wanted to sign up and use the service right away. So it was a good problem to have, but we're trying to lock before we run. We're trying to turn our early customers into successful case studies. So in terms of, I think, them seeing the product, seeing the demo, and seeing the value, that's been incredibly encouraging. In terms of implementation, it typically takes one of our customers about 10 to 15 minutes to get up and running. It's just as easy as implementing, say, Google Ads system on your site.
So this is 48 out of 50 publishers that wanted to sign up right away.
Yeah. Another two actually had exclusive relationships with particular ad networks.
Will you be doing these as exclusive?
Will we be doing this as exclusive? Is that what you asked?
Yeah, will you ask publishers to sign any kind of exclusive deal with you for this kind of stuff?
Yeah. No, not at all. Hmm. Not at all. We believe in putting our money where our mouth is, and we feel that if we're adding something that's of value and we're delivering results to the customers, then they'll continue to use us. And if we get, they will.
And obviously, once you've got the publishers to sign up, then the advertisers will automatically come up with
it. The ad networks, yeah. We don't deal directly with advertisers.
So you want to
That's an important part of our business. We feel that we just want to be really effective channel managers and do the best job that we can in helping the ad networks work really well with the publishers.
Interesting. So why would you turn down working with advertisers?
It's just an issue of how we want to build out this business and channel conflict. We consider the ad networks our channels to reach the advertisers. There's 300 of them. They're all going out and spending a lot of time, effort, and money building ad sales teams. And we just see that there's this big inefficiency between the ad networks and the publishers, and if we can help them all work better together, we don't see a need to actually go touch the end advertiser directly. We just like to supply the ad networks and the tools. We want to supply the ad networks with the tools and the information that they need to be more successful in working with the advertisers to create more value for publishers.
At least for the first year or two, right? This is my cynical Australian side coming up. I mean,
no, you know, I think we can go build a successful business doing this. I think it's something that really requires commitment and requires investment.
Dude, you know what you're doing.
Just like,
if you pull this off, if you pull this off, you're going to own internet advertising.
We're going to own internet advertising?
Yeah, I mean, you could potentially have every publisher on the internet signed up for what you're doing. I mean, this is pretty powerful what you're talking about here. This isn't trivial. This isn't kid stuff.
Well, first, thank you. But yeah, I mean, absolutely. I wouldn't say we'd own internet advertising, but we would certainly be very happy if every publisher on the internet, you know, signed up for our service. And we think that, you know, really in order for this to work, that's why it's important for us to work really well with the ad networks and commit to them and not compete with them. Because if we could do that, then we're solving a big part of the equation for them, which is, you know, accessing inventory and doing so in a very predictable way. And, you know, we're dealing with everyone from small blogs to large sites. And a lot of these ad networks don't have the, you know, capacity to go out there and, you know, manage, you know, thousands of relationships with the small sites.
Yeah, but you are helping them with their inventory. I mean, they know that their job is managing that relationship between advertiser and publisher. And by you stepping in, you're cutting away half that relationship with the advertiser side, the publisher side, sorry.
I think we're cutting away because we are, again, you're being very transparent about the whole thing. So they do have control over, you know, which publishers they work with. They do have the same rights and interests that they do today in terms of, you know, content and things like that. So it's not necessarily cutting it out. I think we're providing a more efficient way to manage and access it. But, you know, at the end of the day, these ad networks do have a pretty big challenge. You know, managing the interests of the advertisers and the interests of the publishers and balancing that is very difficult. They're very conflicting interests, right? At the end of the day, the advertisers want to pay the least for ad space, and the publishers want to make the most.
Right.
So what these ad networks today have to do is they have to balance that and find a, you know, happy medium to make them both happy. And I think that's, you know, creating a large challenge for them in a business. So, you know, I do believe that we can help them with that challenge and help the publishers be more successful and help the ad networks also be more successful with their ability to manage advertisers. At the end of the day, the advertisers are the ones that are paying the ad networks and they're their customers.
Yeah, fair enough. So, small questions. Let's say I'm a CPA network. So let's say I'm primary ads, and I've got, I don't know, say 200 offers in my network, and I want to work with you guys. How do I do that? How do I tag them? How many offers do you take, and how does that sort of thing work on the case of a CPA network?
Well, there's two ways. One is, we do have a group that is working specifically with the ad networks to figure out the best way to get them involved in the system. Mm-hmm. In that case, you know, everyone of these networks have different technology, different ways that they do business, different ways that they traffic tag. So we take the time to learn that and figure out how they normally work with publishers, and we'd essentially mimic that in the process. In our product, publishers have the ability to choose certain preferences on the types of ads and the types of networks that they like to work with. They can pick them individually, or they can set preferences and let the system pick it automatically for them. In which case, then, you know, the ad networks, whatever information they give us, we'd make that available to the publishers, so the ad network can be selected to work with that publisher. At the same time, the networks can also give us certain limitations and restrictions on the publishers that they like to work with or not like to work with. They have to have certain restrictions on content. Like some folks, some networks don't like to work on you know, social networking content or user generated content, as an example. So once we have that information, that's available in the system, so publishers can actually get matched up with these ad networks. Once that's established, then as publishers, you know, sign up and use this, we're essentially connecting them to the network, but we're doing all the work to, you know, figure out which tags to use, which CPA network ads or offers are performing on certain pieces of content, you know, based on that demographic, geographic, and contextual analysis.
And so that's, so you,
does that answer your question? I think I rambled a little bit.
No, so you, yeah, to make sure I do understand it. So you kind of go in with a behavioral targeting, some behavioral guessing in the beginning, I guess we could say, and then and based on the tags within a network. And so let's say that guessing then led you to decide that a debt lead generation offer was the right offer to run. And so then that'll then start showing from the CPA network. So you'll drive a bunch of debt leads until the effect of CPM drops. And then you may put something else in from that network if that network could perform consistently on that kind of traffic, or otherwise you'll switch them out, which it could be some kind of display ad from one of the banner networks.
That's correct.
What percentage do you guys take?
You know, we actually haven't committed to a revenue model just yet. What we're planning on doing is taking this thing through our alpha and our beta and having the, you know, publishers see the type of value that they get from the system and work very closely with them to figure out what that should be. Our reaction, though, is to make it very performance-based and to take, you know, a little bit, a lot, is the best way for me to describe it. We don't want to really interfere with the way the business occurs today. What we want to do is essentially be kind of like the, you know, the Visa, you know, back-end transaction platform for internet advertising to really make the facilitating and buying and selling advertising between the networks and the publishers much more efficient. They're very similar to Visa. They supply technology to retailers to process credit cards, and they supply cards to consumers. And they're just facilitating the flow of transactions between them. And they take a small percentage of the revenue, and as the retailer makes more money, Visa makes more money, and if they don't make money, then Visa doesn't pay.
So
that's kind of the model that we're looking at, but we haven't exactly committed to punches yet.
So Visa takes it ends up being something like 1%, doesn't it? Are you talking about that kind of number, or more like, or a bigger number than that?
We're looking at the single digit range.
Right. And would there be any fees at all, or is it all going to be commission-based?
It would all be commission-based. So in terms of fees, I assume you mean like a licensing fee?
Yeah, so basically a publisher can say, okay, everybody's been doing a bad job monetizing my inventory, I'm gonna stick these guys in and see how it does. And there's no cost, they just stick the tags in and then they're off and running.
That's right. Yeah, people will be able to come to our website, create an account, be up and running, that same day within 15-20 minutes, trying out the service.
And obviously,
just like you would with say a Google AdSense today.
Right. And obviously, it will be a big area for you, and so you'll be filling in your international traffic with some of these international networks.
Yeah, I mean, the way the system first starts working is it's gap filling and it's cherry picking. It's looking at where things are monetized and finding ways to fill those gaps and monetize them. It's not necessarily right off the bat about trying to make people compete to make it from a dollar CPM to a dollar five CPM. There's so much inefficiency and so much inventory that's just not monetized that we can provide a lot of lift to publishers and simple gap filling.
Well, I just need to add in here, because I actually wrote an article about this basic concept about 3 or 4 months ago. So transcribe if you make sure you leave space, and we'll put this article link in. I think what you're doing here is brilliant. It's really good. Someone's figured out the right way to implement this stuff. That makes a lot of sense to me. So.
Well, thank you.
So I would say this is one of the best interviews I've had this year. So good stuff.
Well, thank you very much. We're very excited about what we're doing.
Yeah, I like it. So tell me.
It's a big idea. We're excited about it, but there's a lot of heavy lifting to do if you had to make it work.
This is the idea that you can sell this one out there and then you can go and buy yourself an island in the Caribbean?
Why would I do that when I could just come visit you?
Well, hey, Mark, what's the idea?
How did we come up with the idea?
Yeah, whose idea was it?
It was really a collection of the initial core team that we pulled together when we were looking at the advertising space. It was really the publishers that came up with the idea. We went out and we talked to about 100 publishers before even committing to starting this business. And we just found that every single one of them said that it's still too hard to present to sell their ads based online. And then when we drilled in a little further, we found that many of them were using all these ad networks, and they were managing it with Excel spreadsheets, and they were doing very complicated things with their ad server to manage it. And there wasn't really a whole lot of intelligence behind the process. Just after we came back and talking to about 100 publishers, they pretty much told us what their biggest pain was, and that's where we said, all right, well, let's go see if we can take a crack at it and sell it.
So did you have this general idea beforehand, or did you just say, hey, advertising market is hot, I mean, there's been some fairly good sales happening recently, let's talk with some of the old team, some of those guys are available, well, why don't we just go and do kind of an informal chat with some publishers and see where the pain points are to see if we can identify something. Is that how you went about, or did you have the idea before you went and talked to publishers?
Yeah, we didn't have a preconceived idea of what the solution would be. Back at MIT Ad Monitor, one of the reasons that we were so successful was because we did focus on the publishers, and we just automated our business, and we threw technology at the problem. So we knew that we wanted to focus on publishers, and we knew that we wanted to create a technology-driven business. In terms of what that end solution was going to be, we didn't have any preconceived notions. It's something where we looked at the space, saw that the publishers were underserved, and we knew that there was some room for improvement there.
So you knew that there was some kind of a problem in there, and then you decided to go in and investigate it further to see if the problem was as big as you thought, finding that it was, and then identifying exactly what the publisher told you, then you came up with a solution.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not a very smart guy, so all six of my businesses, I decided to find big markets, because big markets are very forgiving, and try to find areas where there's lots of players, and then I just go ask what ask those players what their biggest problems are, and that's where I start. Certainly no brilliance online trying to figure that out. It's just find the best to just ask customers what they want.
And then give it to them.
Yes.
What you're saying here, there was actually, do you remember the company called Vignette?
I do, yes.
I was in a forum where the founder was talking, and for those listening, Vignette's a publishing company. I think they kind of faded now, but they were very big during the late 90s. And they helped websites manage their content. And I asked the guy, where did the idea come from? And he talked exactly about that point, that they went out and asked publishers what their biggest pain point was. And they all were saying that, man, it is a pain managing these websites. We're new to all this internet stuff, and getting your content up all the time is a lot of work. And so Vignette came up and put together a system for managing that. And yeah, so what you're saying is you identify them, there was something there, and then just went and asked a lot of questions about what the exact problem was.
Yep, absolutely.
And so has that been the process behind all of the companies you started?
Yes, all actually except for one. And that one company was a wireless company in 2001. Mm-hmm. And as you know, in 2001 was not a good time to be starting companies, and certainly not a good time to be starting wireless companies. It was an emerging market that had never emerged.
Right.
Therefore, there wasn't. I didn't have the opportunity to go ask people what do you want, in terms of wireless applications, because they didn't know.
So, in hindsight, was that a mistake? Is your process now to always make sure you can go and ask people this kind of stuff, or would you still have done what you did then?
Yeah, it is. I think there are the types of entrepreneurs that go out and create markets. Like the YouTube guys, as an example. More power to them. It's a lot of risk and a lot of work to get there, but. I think the second type of entrepreneur is one that finds the existing market with existing problems and then just picks some problems to go and solve. And my approach has been, I think, the latter. I don't think either one is right or wrong. I think it's just an issue of leveraging your skill set and a risk balance comes especially with it.
Well, you've got a potential. This is not even just a base hit. This is potentially a home run with what we've done here. So, yeah. All right. Good stuff. So, some more questions. How did you get funding?
How did we get funding?
I noticed, I guess, you didn't go back to Sequoia.
We raised our first round of funding. It was a seed round of funding from Clearstone Venture Partners. Clearstone actually invested in Overture, if you remember, and also invested in companies like PayPal and NetZero and CarCrisis.com. We decided to go with them, actually, because they are right down the street from us. They're here local to us in Santa Monica, and that, combined with our experience with Overture, was something that we thought was a good combination. Mm.
And then another question, this is actually not related to your current company, but to your previous one, I just really would like to ask this. You've taken the company public. I mean, so were you the CEO when it went public?
No, I was the CEO.
How did that work? I mean, did you go down on the NASDAQ floor and I don't know, stand there as it went public? How did that happen?
In terms of the day that we went public?
Yeah, I mean, what happened on the day when you went
public? I wasn't personally on the NASDAQ floor. It was the CEO and the CFO that were in New York. And I was back at our headquarters in Santa Monica, so I keep the business running.
All right. What did they do? I mean, so if they're in New York, did you go to the public on the New York Stock Exchange?
We did, yeah. No, I'm sorry, NASDAQ.
It was NASDAQ? Did they, in the New York Stock Exchange, they get to go and ring the bell and that kind of stuff? Did you get to do any of that kind of thing?
No, the company didn't get to ring the bell.
So what happened? Did they just stand up there and then just another start? I mean, was there any kind of celebration? Did you guys all have a big party back in Santa Monica? Got any stories? I'm interested to hear.
Interesting enough, the company was very grounded and very realistic. Mm-hmm. I think we started the company on good fundamentals. We didn't start it with venture capital. We didn't start it chasing the IPO dream. We just focused on building a great business and, ended up in an IPO. So when the IPO came along, we really looked at it as the beginning and not the end. We're definitely celebrations. We had a celebration the day up, but it was really not that much different than any other company celebration that we have. We had a happy hour. But we didn't go out and do anything, super extravagant. And then a little while later, we actually had an official IPO party where we brought all the office together from all over the world. And Abe and I did. But it wasn't, it was funny, it was a little less about the IPO and more about just, celebrating our continued success.
Well, like when you got drunk.
That makes any sense.
And jump off a bridge or anything like that. you got...
I think we just looked at it as just another stage revolution in the business.
Right. That's very mature. I mean, that's because almost done pretty well at that point, especially with the markets way back then.
Yeah, it was definitely a good time. We actually went public on the day of the first stock market crash.
Oh.
There were some challenges there, and DoubleClick had filed a patent infringement lawsuit against us the week before.
Okay.
So it was definitely some trying times, but we still did have a successful IPO in spite of both of those things.
No.
And it was again, we just looked at it as another evolutionary stage of business.
All right. Fair enough. Cool. Well, we've talked a lot about your current project. Is there any things you want to tell us about we haven't covered? I mean, you're looking to hire people. There's obviously going to be a lot of networks reading this. What are you looking for? How can people help you? And anything that we haven't covered?
Yeah, actually, hiring is something that's a huge priority for us right now. We're trying to hire great people. The culture of the company is something that's really important to us. It's not just people with fantastic experience, but I think it's people with fantastic personalities that they're looking for. We've got actually about 15 people that we're looking to hire pretty much immediately. That's a big area of focus for us. Another area of focus for us is certainly in establishing stronger relationships with the ad networks. We do feel like we can have a lot of value to them as well if we can work closely together. And then lastly, of course, publishers. More publishers the merrier. We'd like to give people create as much value for as many publishers as possible.
Right. So any of those kind of people that are reading this, so if you're a publisher in our network or looking for a job, then they think they should get in touch. And I guess they can reply to my interview and then I'll forward their info on to you.
Yes, absolutely. They can also go to our website at rubiconproject.com. We have a lot of information up there, and we also have everybody's email address. So if they want to connect with anyone here directly or individually at the company, they can do that. We have all of our email addresses posted.
Well, that's even better. Then go directly. That's much better. Cool. Anything else you'd like to add in closing?
No, thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity. Some great questions. I think this is a fantastic interview.
Cool. Thanks very much.
Thank you.